Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should have an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Right, well, playing it right back. And it's a good cross for Quinn! Delivered by David White. Met by Niall Quinn.
Quinn's header. It's in! Niall Quinn has saved it!
On by Quinn, who drives for goal! Well, at Main Road, they really have formed a great attachment to Niall Quinn. And Quinn is onside. If he can get it down here, there's trouble for Sunderland, who scored. Hours missed kicks, and Quinn has equalised.
That was Van Aerle, and Van Rijn has lost it.
Niall, good head of the ball. Big 6 foot five, I think he is. But I didn't want him to play in the sense that you're knocking balls about or you're controlling balls. Finish them off when you get a chance of a header in it. Change the direction of the ball. Bring other people into the game. And it took a while for Niall to get the hang of it, but when he did, he became a regular with us all the time.
My own personal favourite would probably be the goal I scored against England at Wembley in March 1991, to score in the sort of home of football of the British Isles. That was a great thrill for me.
This is Ray Houghton. McGrath. In goes Quinn. Yes, it's there!
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You didn't recognise all those goals, did you?
Oh, I did.
You did?
Definitely, yeah. You kind of hang on to moments the older you get, Ger. So, yeah, nice to hear them back again.
Good evening. You're very welcome. We've been excited about this.
Yeah, very much so. We've been asking for 6 months, so it's nice that he can finally come in anyway.
So Jack Charlton saying he didn't want you to play, and you know, Jack takes a lot of credit for a lot of stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah, sure. He probably had a point. You know, I thought when I turned up with the Irish team that what I had to do was be really impressive, get the ball and show them what I can do, and take players on and show that I can score with my feet, and it wasn't the right thing to do at all with Jack, to be honest with you. And you know, he'd say things to you like, you know, when did we ever ask you to kick it? Just head it, you know, stuff like that all the time. And he'd be talking to you and I'd maybe give him the ball away. I remember Dennis Irwin went on an overlap one night away to Denmark, which was a big important game for us. It was 0-0 late on. He went on an overlap and I did really well to hold the ball up. And I knocked it a yard behind him, and of course they went on the attack, and I could see Jack reaching for the numbers to try and get my number to come up. So, yeah, he frightened the life out of you, really, into not doing things like that. I mean, even though I did the odd time, but...
It might have been Dennis's number for actually going on the overlap. That's what it might have been.
It could well have been, but... Do you know, I kind of benefited probably as much as anyone from Jack Charlton and what he came and brought to it all. And it suited my game. And once, as he said, once I did stop running around. But you see, he also asked big asks of you in terms of off the ball work. So he kind of had a point in many ways, and it's been played out later. When Carlos Queiroz came to Manchester United and said, you only need one centre forward, Alex, you know, we'll play a different way. And they went on to win more titles. Jack had a bit of that in his makeup. Certainly off the ball. So if the other team had possession, you had to, as a centre forward, run and make up a fifth midfielder. So we had a little bit of tactical nous, certainly when we didn't have the ball. But it was really hard for the players to sort of understand and do it and work it well. Frank Stapleton started it. You know, Trojan did it great. Aldo did it for a few games. I come in, and Aldo, clever enough, slipped me into that role. And although one night I can remember, Aldo, I vividly remember, I think it might have been away in Spain or something, and I remember him saying in the interview afterwards, my legs are turning into tree stumps, I just can't keep it up, and when the chance comes, then my legs are too tired to score. So we worked ever so hard. Never forget the time with him. It's great fun, and I benefited probably more than anyone. So you know, I don't like anyone who says a bad word about him. I don't like to hear it. He was kind of inspirational for us all at that time.
That period of your life, right, it kind of comes after you making it at Arsenal at the start. There's a bunch of funny situations where it looks like you're not going to make it because you don't get offered a contract in your first trial, and then other things come into your life and you're like, oh well, I'm going to do a bit of this, There's various stages where it could have gone either way.
Well, absolutely. I went off to Australia in the summer of 1983. We'd qualified for the All-Ireland Hurling Final, but I went off for 5 weeks to Australia to play Aussie Rules football. I got offered a contract. I got offered two contracts, Sydney Swans and Melbourne. The reason I didn't know I was offered either contract when I came back was there was a postal strike in Sydney or in Australia at the time, and no internet, no other way of contacting people. So I played the All-Ireland Hurling Final, Galway beat us, and 2 days later the Arsenal scout Bill Darby called to my house and asked me to go to Arsenal for a trial. I hadn't played a football match since the April. And I laughed at him. Went, are you sure? He went, no. He said, I watched you. You played a school final. You were outstanding in Talca Park. And I know you went to Fulham and they didn't like you as a centre-half when you were 15, but now I want you to go and try and be a centre-forward. So I actually went and said, well, I'll enjoy this. It'll get me out of school for a week, you know. It was actually meant to be a two-week trial. And I had a lucky break, guys. And sometimes, you know, you need things to happen for you. But all the young lads who were at the club were off. It was their first week off since the pre-season. And so when I went in September, there was no kids for me to train with. The reserves had two matches, so I ended up training with the first team on my trial. And because I wasn't nervous, because I, you know, thought it wasn't going to go well anyway, I was at ease with it, and I fitted in quite well. And then I ended up playing one of the reserve games. We actually won it 12-0, and I got three, and Paul Merson got six. And we came off the pitch, and never forget Merce saying, I should have known he was going to be a gambler from then on. He said, we're a million on to get a contract. And I didn't know what that meant, you know. so they were memories. And literally, you know, 4 or 5 days into the trial, Terry Neal, who was the manager then, came into the dressing room and said, come on up here. And he spoke and he said, look, we're going to send you back home now. And I thought, here we go again. I got this at Fulham a couple of years earlier. And he went, we're going to send you home. Get yourself ready. Get yourself out of school. We're going to offer you a contract and we'll be over to your mum and dad in the next week or two. So it was that quick. So there was no development programs with the FAI at Abbottstown, or there was no sort of extra training for me or extra coaching. There was no sort of idea that I was going to be a footballer. I'd actually lost the idea that I was going to be a footballer when Malcolm McDonald at Fulham politely told me in his terms that as long as I had a hole in my backside, I would never make a footballer. And it was nice to get the chance to prove him wrong.
Come here, you were 15 then when you went for the trial at Fulham. So yeah. Fulham, you're having that trial and he says this to you. So was that it then? Did you just give up any idea in your own head then at that time that was it? You're never going to make it?
More or less. And I can remember he said, but here you are. Here's a memory of your time here. And he gave me a signed football with all the Fulham players on it. And Fulham were in the second tier at that point. Now, they were well clear and looked certainties to be promoted, and they blew it in the end. But I can remember coming out, and as you come out of Fulham, there's a park that you walk by, and there's a wall, and over the wall is the River Thames. And I was looking at the ball, like, will I boot this in, or is that just really bad of me, you know? And I didn't actually. I brought it home and gave it to a neighbour of ours. And I came back, and I'd played at Manortown United for many years, and I just thought, okay, I'm not going to go ahead with this. I'm going to take the hurling more seriously now. And there was a period of time for a few months when football meant nothing to me. And Lord Celtic came knocking for me in the summer and asked me to come down and play a year above my age. So I was 16, but I was playing under 17s. And we got to the Pepsi Cola Cup final against Home Farm, which was an under 18 competition. So I was well out of my age group, but it started to happen for me again. And
still a centre half, or
no? I moved further up the field then. Yeah, cleared me away out of the defensive responsibilities. And you know, I have great people to thank there: Murray Price at Lord Celtic, Bower Bradley. These were great characters in Dublin at the time. Great football characters. I'd have to mention Kieran Flaherty, my manager at Manortown for years and years. And you know, all great people who just, you know, give everything to the young lads at that time. It's more structured now and more staged. If you show promise, you're in development squads and you move into different academies and what have you. But then it was almost street football to a point. You know, you were playing maybe Cherry Orchard up in Ballyfermot, and there was more at stake, you know, than just your own personal sort of pathway here. This was, you know, big matches. Lord Celtic playing Cherry Orchard on the hill. You know, crowds would come to it. The first time crowds were watching you, and, you know, the crowds were pretty tough as well, like, you know, so you had to perform. And I'll never forget those times really coming through, because I had no idea I was going to be a footballer. As I told you, it happened not by accident, but it happened so quickly. But I definitely picked up, you know, I suppose something from the street, if you like, that stood to me when it come to playing U team games and reserve team games, make my way through to try and get into the Arsenal first team.
is it a bit of a fluke that you actually end up getting scouted? Because, I mean, if you've kind of given up and you're thinking, actually, maybe I'll go and play Aussie Rules, because that would have been a nice lifestyle.
Well, yeah, it could have been. It was a bit far away from home, but at the same time, it was something that I really enjoyed. I was the captain of Dublin College's team that went out there. We were the guinea pigs, the first people to play, actually, a mixture of Aussie Rules and Gaelic football. And in the end, we played complete Aussie Rules for the last few matches. And it was really enjoyable, and we had great stars coming, teaching us and training out there. Dipper Domenico, you might remember these guys. Hawthorne had a great team. There was a fellow Dermot Brereton.
Yeah.
They were all great guys. And there was a coach at Melbourne, very famous coach, Ron Barassi, huge character in Aussie Rules. And these people, you know, they were very personal with me, and I possibly might have done that. But I think once Arsenal came and asked me to go, that was it, you know. So yeah, I was very lucky, and I must point out that Bill Darby later said that he went to that school's final to watch a player from Ballymun Comprehensive, not me. And so I never ever forget how lucky I was.
Is that something you carry with you then when you kind of get over to Arsenal? Because, like, it's not that you're on a shot to nothing here, but actually, if it doesn't work out, you kind of still have that sense of actually. Well, do you know what I mean? Because obviously you're taking it seriously, and I know you're taking it seriously, but at the same time there's a sense of freedom to it.
Yeah, there wasn't much pressure on me, in as much that I hadn't been told from 13 years of age that I've been in the development academies, that I'm a great player and that loads of clubs want me. I didn't have 4 years, or my family didn't have 4 years of your son's a great player, he's going to be doing this, he's going to be doing that. It just literally, I arrived in London and I was at Arsenal. So from that point of view, I feel really sorry for the young players and the pressures they're put under. Not necessarily by their mothers and fathers, but just the way it all sort of builds up around them as they're going to Arsenal on trial, or they're going here, there and everywhere. And it's a tough one to carry with me. I didn't have that. So when I went to London, it was an adventure. I treated it as an adventure. And my mother and father would only let me go in the first instance if I promised to complete my studies and if I lived with my auntie and uncle. So that was great for a few months. And then I dropped the studying because it really was tiring. I you know, the training was immense. And
was this Leaving Cert College or what?
Yeah, it was to get two A levels, one in English and one in history. And my English teacher was Kate Hoey, who later went on to be a famous politician in England. And she was great, but it was just too much for me, you know. And I think the history then, it was very hard being an Irishman trying to do a history degree in London when, you know, Oliver Cromwell was fated the way he was by the English. And I'm there saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, we're not all of that persuasion.
Yeah.
So I dropped both of them. And
where did all the money come from to build these nice buildings?
Yeah. Well, that's true. But yeah, that's a fair point. Now, what kind of debate will we start now? But so it was an adventure, as I say. And going back at that time, I had a bad first year. I knew the coaches weren't sure about me at the lower level. There was two good coaches. Terry Burton, you know, went on to be a very successful first team coach, did odd management in the lower leagues, and Tommy Coleman. But they just weren't sure about me because I had a bit of catching up to do on the basics. You know, I had strength, I was good in the air, what have you. But in understanding the game, I was way behind. And it didn't really happen for me till the end of that first year. I had a poor first year in the youth team. But they'd given me 3 years in the contract, and the second year I was able to start every week in the youth team. And Pat Rice, in his first job after football, after quitting as a player, he was my youth team coach, and he really got a hold of me and sorted me out and put me into a great place in my head, physically, and my work rate, in my self-belief, and had a great year. And then the third year was the interesting one because I only had the year left. Not like now where you can let your contracts run out and things go well and you go off on your bosom. There's nothing like that. You're just desperate to try and get another contract. And I had to go into the reserves. I had no youth team to fall on then. It was all or nothing. And there was no under 23s, under 21s. This was straight in. You're dealing with, you know, great players who are maybe injured and playing, and you're dealing with tough men. I can remember playing against Chelsea, Mickey Droy. There's a name I'll throw at you. If you ever see pictures of him, he was like Grizzly Adams. Do you remember that programme?
Yeah.
And I remember marking him as a scrawny young 18-year-old in one of the first reserve games. I remember our goalkeeper kicking a ball out, and I was just about to go up and take a big 1-2-3 and head it, and he just stopped me with one arm, held me back and headed it straight back into our goalkeeper's hands. Like, you know, he was a monster. So it was quite tough, but I ended up getting on a goal run, and I got 19 goals by the middle of December in that year, and the first team were really struggling. I was to go on loan to Portsmouth. Another thing here now, Jeff, how important luck is. I was to go on loan to Portsmouth on the Thursday. I brought into the travel office. They gave me the tickets to go to the station, King's Cross. John Rudge of Port Vale was meeting me there to go on loan for a month. And when I got to the station, there was a message over the man, and Niall Quinn make himself known to one of the staff. They went back. You've got to go back to Arsenal. There was an injury in training. So I went back in, and Don Howe was the manager by then. He said, listen, you can't go till Monday. Tony Woodcock has got injured in training. You're not involved with the first team tomorrow, but we'll just keep you nearby. Trained with the reserves the next day, went home, thought nothing of it. Turns out Paul Mariner got injured on the Friday. And I came in on the Saturday morning. After training on the Friday, my name was included at the bottom of the squad in pencil. So I thought, well, it was nice to be involved. Told nobody, didn't want anyone to know. Got a train then into Finsbury Park, because on a Saturday morning you get the Irish newspaper. I got the Irish Independent, looked at the back of it, and I was all over it. Whirling Star to make debut for Arsenal. And I thought, oh God, they've got it so wrong. And I walked up there and I was playing, and Don Howe picked me. And so I had no tickets. I didn't even get a ticket for anyone on my debut. Arsenal were playing Liverpool. They were a mighty team then, Liverpool. And it was all surreal. And then, you know, we won for the first time in a long time. Liverpool lost for the first time. And it all took off for me. You know, there's no chartered pathways there for young players. There's just nothing but a pile of luck. And in the middle of it all, I got through.
How did the game go?
We won 2-0. And we stopped a run, as I say, of poor performances. I think Everton had beaten Arsenal 6-0 a couple of weeks beforehand, and I managed to get one after 20 minutes. So another Van Breukelen moment, where Van Breukelen, who I'll be buying drinks for every time I see him for the rest of my life, for throwing that ball to me. Well, Bruce Grobbelaar did something similar on my debut. And you know, it's amazing. I do coaching clinics sometimes with kids and that, and I try and tell them the importance of following in shots, that goalkeepers spill things. And they look at me and they don't do it, you know, and I'm saying, you know, you have no idea what it would mean. And go back and look at your videos. And those two goals, you know, they were two important goals to get, you know, one, obviously, to get off and running as a footballer, not Premier League then, but first division footballer, as it was. And then to get my international career off and running. So always grateful to goalkeepers who spill a few.
Scoring on your debut after 20 minutes against Liverpool, like the great Liverpool team.
How old are you then, Quinny? So you were 17?
I was 18, 18 just about to turn 19. And I just turned 19, I beg your pardon. But I still only had 6 months left in my contract.
Right.
And I stayed in the team. We got to the Littlewoods Cup final, which is the League Cup final then, and we beat Liverpool, which is...
It's 87.
87. So I made my debut in 85. Sorry, 87. I stayed in the team till the end of the season. Sorry, that's right. I stayed in the team till the end of the season, 85, 86. And I was in the first team, didn't know whether I'd get a new contract. I mean, so different. Now, can you imagine getting in at that point? I think I was on £125 a week at the time, and hoping to God that I get another contract, even though I'd been in the first team that long. No such thing as Bosman rule, what have you. The clubs had all the power. And I went in. Don Howe had left the club as the last game or two of the season happened, because we fell away after a good run. And George Graham took over in the summer, got invited back to speak to him. And he said, I'm not sure about you. I'll give you a year on the same money. And so I had to go and prove myself all over again to George Graham. And I did. I had a good year that year. And halfway through, the thing that hurt me the most, which I shouldn't have done, he gave me a 4-year deal on about £300 a week, bless him. And I accepted it. And that became a noose around my neck, because Alan Smith came to the club and they had me tied up, you know, very cheaply, of course. Yeah. And I sat and suffered then for a couple of years. And you know, I'm not bitter about that. Alan Smith was a terrific player, but the problem was he never got injured and he never got booked. So you were kind of working away, hoping for a glimpse, and in the end, you kind of get a bit demoralised and you think, ah, you know what, I'll go out tonight. I'll go to the Dogs tonight. I'll go out to the Irish club tonight. I'll go out. And in the end, you're kind of doing yourself no favours. But eventually, George let me go and things started to happen for me again at Man City.
Right, Niall, as if by magic, obviously, we have a surprise guest for you on the line. It's this guy. Have a listen.
Dipping! Oh, Paul Merson has pulled a rabbit out of the hat. Oh, my goal! Merson! Paul Merson's marksmanship, absolutely superb.
Paul, good evening to you. How are you doing?
Evening.
Niall was telling us that you two made your trial together.
And I was waiting for... couldn't he guess who it is yet?
Just a bit.
Do you remember that trial?
Yeah. We played it at Southall, it was. Yeah, first game, Quinny come over and he ripped you up. I think he got about 5 goals that night, Quinny.
No, I think I got 3. You got 6. I remember it well.
Did I?
And we came off and you went, "We're a million on, son. We're a million on." And I had no idea what you meant, but I do now.
You do now, yeah. we used to play in the reserves, didn't we? In the evening, we'd sit in the betting shop all day. And then we'd go and get a spicy pizza and have that round, draw fat. And then go.
There was a bookies, Jennings of Enfield. And honestly, it was like a war. We're going to go in and do them today. We're actually going to... And we even thought about robbing it and everything, didn't we? Oh, it was terrible. Right, listen, great times.
I still have them thoughts now.
One of the best ones, Paul. Do you remember the dog at Wembley that you backed that was going to win by so far, but it got so far behind that it turned around and started running the other way? Do you remember?
So did I when it started doing it.
Yeah, those were the days, eh?
You guys were thick as thieves, it sounds like. You became friends immediately.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, very much so.
We'd common interests.
Yeah.
So, the horses and the dogs and a few pints. And in fairness, Paul and I, you know, we weren't sort of the string fellas at that point anyway in our careers. We were kind of going to the bank of friendship around the corner, weren't we? And
pint of Guinness,
playing darts with lads for money. Yeah. And so, yeah, it was good. It was different. So we were kind of able to do that. We were away, you know, there was never going to be paparazzi where we were going, put it that way. And there was no mobile phones too, thank God, Mercy.
No, cool, not many.
Yeah, I think, Paul, Niall spoke earlier about a different age in football as well. You didn't have, you know, you weren't on huge money. You were breaking into the side at that time. So it goes back to the point that so many probably of lads from your era make, that you probably wouldn't have had it any other way. I know that wages now, of course, dictate football, and huge salaries are across the board, even at the lesser clubs. But it was a different age, but the fun was certainly there around football at that particular time, though.
Yeah, hello, Kev. You're right, mate. Yeah, definitely. I think people do say, people go, "Oh, you'd rather play now, you know, you're on this and that." It was fun in them days. It was. There wasn't as much pressure as what are on the players in this day and age. I mean, every pass, everything's under the microscope now. But no, I loved it. I mean, it was one of them times I loved playing. And, you know, I wouldn't have swapped it. I really wouldn't have. Seriously, I mean, straight after a game, you'd go out and you could have a laugh. You could. I feel sorry for some of them now. I mean, look at Barkley the other week. I mean, you go out and before you know it, you're getting a smack.
Quinny's quite nervous here. He's getting edgy. He's getting very edgy in his seat when you're talking here.
No,
now.
I'm just thinking, would I change anything? You know, definitely some of them certainties that you brought in to the dressing room where that couldn't be beat. I have to tell the lads about the Steve Davis, Joe Johnson one. Am I all right to tell that one?
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
So we didn't have much money, so Merce come in. He went, "I've got a plan." And he went to all the first team players at the time. Steve Williams gave you 50 quid. I'll never forget it. He said, "I want to pile up a bit of money. It's nothing illegal, but I've got a certainty, and I'll give you 25% on your money tomorrow." I don't even think you said certainty. You think you said it was a scheme. And you remember it? And everybody started giving you money. And I came in, "What is it? What is it?" And he said to me, "Steve Davis against Joe Johnson. He's a pub singer." Do you remember that? And we went, I went along and I went, "Yeah, I'll have a bit of that, you know." Oh, we come in the next day, we were on our knees, weren't we? "Please, lads." And I can remember you saying, "Snooker's bent." they did it for the TV, and Steve Williams had you by the throat.
And Steve Williams is the tightest man in the world, wasn't he? Giving me 50 quid was like giving me his life.
They were good times.
Oh, brilliant.
Did they not spot you two a mile off coming, "Here come these two again with their fifth or sixth plan in 5 weeks"?
Not many.
Another one we did, you had it. Do you remember we went off on a flight somewhere? George brought us off to Bermuda or something, and you got out the roulette table in the emergency exit of the British Airways flight, and the air hostesses let us put it up. It was one of them ones that stood. And we got this fella drunk. Do you remember the American? We got him drunk and took his glasses off him, and he couldn't see what he was betting on.
I used to take say that everywhere, didn't I? Roulette, little roulette thing. You could play it in the middle of the exit.
It was brilliant. Yeah. He kept telling him, look, you mate black, you know, and he was there.
And then that other bloke looked at us evil with his wife, and then when we checked in, he was checking in behind us.
That's right, yeah, he wanted to get in, yeah. Oh, it was funny, yeah.
That was when we sent George's boy, wasn't it, across the other side of...
Oh, yeah, that, I have to tell that. George Graham's son came on the trip, and, I don't know, the poor fella felt for him, but he let us go out one night, and Bermuda's kind of like a horseshoe, and everybody goes out where the middle is, and we were staying around one end of the horseshoe, which is about 10 miles that way. And we all come out of this bar about 3 in the morning, and George had said to me, you got to look after Daniel. You got to look after my son, Quinny. You're the sensible one. I went, aye, okay. And we got there and went, and he had too much to drink, so he had to go on before us. So we went out to the taxi driver, and Merce went, I'll handle this. And he went, where's the Hamilton Hotel? And he went, 10 miles that way. He went, where's the other end? He went, 10 miles that way. He went, take that lad and leave him off as far as you can on the bar. He had to send a search party out for him the next day. Do you remember that? Oh, my God, I thought we were going to get sent home. Do you remember? Oh, dear. Great times. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Paul, when did you start making the team? Was it straight away?
No. I went on loan to Brentford for about 10 games. And then I come back. I got 97, 98. So, no, not really. No, I didn't get in for quite a while. So, I had to be patient. I was very small and skinny when I was younger, believe it or not. Believe it or not. Yeah, very. So, I had to be quite patient. I was quite lucky I got a break because I got in the team, scored 3 in 5, and then they bought Alan Smith for about 750 grand, which was a lot of money. And then at the end of the season, they put in a big, big bid for Tony Cotty to come from West Ham, and he chose to go to Everton. And if he didn't go to Everton, I probably would have never played for Arsenal. I mean, that's how lucky you've got to get sometimes.
So both you and Quinny have a bit of beef with Alan Smith then, yeah?
Smudge. I mean, I ended up playing with Smudge, and I mean, great partner. He's well underrated. I mean, I thought Quinny was top draw. I'm not just saying it, is he? I mean, he's the only man I know in the world who could get up in the air and head the ball where he wanted to head the ball. A lot of people go up and just flick the ball wherever and hope that the centre forward reads it. But Quinny used to go up and head it down. He was an unbelievable touch. I know people go, oh, good touch for a big lad. You should have a good touch, but he had an exceptional touch, you know, a good as touch as someone who's 5'5", if I'm being honest.
He's right. He's right with that one. Oh, he's totally right with that one. And I think many a centre forward or many a goal scorer that now would have played with over the years, with testament to that. I had it with Kevin Phillips at Sunderland, and half the goals, if not three quarters of the goals that Kevin Phillips would have scored, would have by and large been down to Niall's work off the ball, and or certainly finding him in certain areas. Kevin was a fantastic goal scorer, but the partnership that they had up there, the way that they had it off for 4 or 5 years, it was just incredible to see the movement from Kevin off Niall. But Niall seemed to know exactly where Kevin went.
We needed the ball put in as well, though. Like, you know, it's kind of you to say that, but I remember Kev's, I think, first game, Ipswich at home, I think, Kev,
Sunderland. Southampton.
Southampton at home, and he gallops down the wing and he puts one across, and it was the best cross, and I've gone in at the far post, and I've gone to put it in with my side foot, and it hits my heel and goes across the goal, and Kev Phillips taps it in. And I'm watching Match of the Day that night, and Jimmy Hill is going, what a clever player Quinn is, so unselfish. I was gutted. And Kev went, oh, why didn't you score yourself? And went, I meant to, Kev.
Oh, brilliant. But no, it's weird now. You never see that, do you, big man, little man? You know, you look at Stoke, and probably Berrino's crying out to play up front with Crouch, you know what I mean, where he can work off him, but...
Mercer, say something with that as well. I watched Man United at the weekend, and they played with Rashford and Lingard up front, and Mourinho, everyone's talking about it being a tactical masterclass from Mourinho, but just the two up front against the three Chelsea defenders, it was something different, and it was great to watch and great to see a side playing something different and going with two up front again, and how they actually exploited Chelsea's weakness.
Yeah, and with the two playing up front, have they got pace to burn?
Yeah.
You know, no one likes to play against pace like that, and to be fair, I just watched the first half of the Man United game and they're a million miles off it. I mean, with Ibrahimovic up front, I know people say, oh, he's, you know, 20-odd goals. You ask these centre-halves, they'd rather be marking him than marking Rashford. You know, every time Man United were breaking, you know, the defenders just stayed high because no one was going to run away. Ibrahimovic is not going to run away from you. So, you know, for me, I think he's going to be an exceptional talent. I think he can go as far as he wants because he's not only just got pace, he can play as well.
Mourinho's not really helping Rashford that much, though, is he? Like he, so
no.
He scored
at the left wing tonight.
Yeah, he scored at the weekend, and the first thing Mourinho did was complain about the shot that he'd missed and the chance. And you're kind of like, he's just scored a brilliant goal, which has like rescued your Premier League season in some ways. Yeah. He's not into giving him confidence.
It's been the peculiar part of Jose's reign at Manchester United that when they do start to show green shoots of recovery, whatever the phrase is, you know, he kind of puts them down himself. Rather than build on that and get more out of his team. I mean, the Shaw stuff was quite incredible. It was almost comical, really, you know, that he would pick on the player the way he did. And I suppose he's looking for the real deep, good ones to come through that and show him that they can sort of play for this club and take all the criticism and all the pressures. But I still say the pat on the back for any footballer at any level, the pat on the back is so important.
Maybe you would have had it as well. Certainly I would have had it coming through, and you were actually the generation before me. But that, I mean, that was the norm back then. There was very little praise given to players, and I can imagine that certainly would have been the case when you two lads coming through at Arsenal with the characters within the coaching staff there at Arsenal as well.
Yeah, but they would, but you know, they'd have a go to you, but I can never remember getting criticised by my manager in the media. Never. I mean, I can remember Howard Kendall one day at Man City. I'd had a terrible game, and somebody said, what did you think of Quinn's performance today? And he said, did you see the work rate he put in off the ball? Do you know the game? If you know the game like me, what a performance that lad had. And the next day, the fella wrote it and said, what a performance from Quinn off the ball. You know, and so you kind of you look at the gaffer and you'd see him on Monday and he'd go, you owe me one. And he'd go, oh, thanks, you know, I will. I'll be so good next week, you know. And that is the exact opposite.
That's good management, isn't it?
Yeah, at the time, it was Howard Kendall. You know, poor man, he died last year. But he was the one who really got me believing in myself that I could actually play. Jack was telling me not to play. Howard was telling me to play. So I was fighting this battle between the two. But thankfully, you know, Howard, and he made me play head tennis every day, which I'd never done. We never did that at Arsenal, did we, Paul? We were regimented the way George trained us for those few years. But once I started playing head tennis, once I got a bit of confidence, you know, I my career took off, and I really put it down to Howard Kendall being the one who's, you know, sort of made me believe it.
Two things. One is about belief, but the other is actually putting the belief into practice. So he's actually improving your physical game while also mentally preparing you to be better.
Listen, I'm going to tell you something here, and Kev will tell you this. At 35 years of age at Sunderland, I played more head tennis than I did at 25. I worked harder on my touch. I didn't like the running. At that point, you're fed up with the running, and you're fed up with the long warm-ups, and you're fed up with the stuff. But the ball becomes precious to you, and time becomes precious to you, and you want everything to go right for you. And you become, I certainly did anyway, I became more driven in those last couple of years, 2 or 3 years at Sunderland, because it was, you know, time was around the corner.
You appreciate it a lot more,
don't
you?
Don't you just,
yeah. You know, when you're 22, 24, you're thinking, oh, this is going to go on forever and ever, this.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose you kind of have regrets. There's no point in saying you don't. You say to yourself, why didn't I train like this when I was at Arsenal when I was 22 and not be in the bank of friendship with you, Merz?
Yeah, go on, blame me.
What was your peak, Paul? What was the time when the manager gave you the confidence?
I'd probably have said I played my best football when I was at Aston Villa, if I'm being honest. I think, you know, I was coming towards the end of, you know, I was 30 years of age then. You sort of, you know the game then more than you do when you're 22, 23. But, you know, then, because you're bought for a bit of money, you can not take liberties, but you can try things in games. You know, Arsenal, if you flick five balls and them five balls didn't come off, you'd be off in 5 minutes. George would rip you off. You know, when I went other places, you know, because you've been bought for good money, you always get that extra opportunity, and you've always got that other, you know, that pass through the eye of a needle. And I loved it. I loved it. When I was playing for Aston Villa, I appreciated football a lot more.
Merz, what message were you given then when you were playing for Aston Villa, going out onto the pitch, match days, day-to-day training?
I have Steve Harrison as my coach, who, for me, I think he's probably one of the best coaches I've ever worked with, if I'm being honest. I thought he was outstanding. But John would just let me go out and play. He would just say, go out and play. Go out and play. I've got runners around you who will work. You just go out and get the ball and try and make things happen. I don't want you running back into your own box and things like that. And I had that with Harry as well. When I went to Portsmouth, I mean, I thought he was outstanding, and I'd be shocked if Birmingham went down now. I don't care what games they got coming up. With Harry there, I'll be shocked if they went down.
Harry says he's not going to get paid if Birmingham were down, so I think we can all say that they will definitely stay up.
Oh, they're definitely staying up then.
Well, I tell you, I must tell you about a point when we were trying to buy Darren Bent for Sunderland. And yes, obviously Daniel Levy was putting an incredible price tag on his head, saying how great he was. And Darren missed a header in the game that weekend. And Harry came on telly and did the opposite of what we're saying now. He said, my missus would have scored that. Yeah. So I used to get on quite well with Daniel Levy. And he kept coming back and saying, no, that's it. That's it. The deal is off. If you don't pay this, the deal is off. And so I said, OK, we're not paying that. And he sent me a text back. Is there anyone else here you'd like to have? And I went, yeah, is Harry's missus available? And he hasn't really spoke to me properly since.
Brilliant.
Oh, magic. Paul, you've been great with your time. Thanks very much for joining us this evening.
No, pleasure. Not at any time for Quinny.
Brilliant, Maris. Great to hear from you.
Come on, thank you.
Thank you, Quinny. See you, lad.
Good luck.
Nice to talk to you again, Kev. Take care,
cheers, Maris. Thank you.
Bye-bye. He was a great player.
Oh, legend in more ways than one. And he was a type of player who at 19, 20, all the senior players loved. You know, one of those people that they just cherish and love having around the place. And he was cheeky, he was arrogant, and he was scheming. Do you know, now that he's off, I can tell you that we all went up as a young lad. He was thinking about his future. He bought a sports shop and we all went up to the opening of it, wished him well, and everything was great. And then about 12 months later, we read in the paper that it closed down. You know, and he went, oh, yeah, he said, made a bit of a mistake there. I bought a sports shop next to Ladbrokes. you know, there was something always really lovable about him. And everywhere he went, you know, fans think great things about him. He came up to Middlesbrough, which he didn't speak about. We were up at Sunderland, and he was getting on a bit then, but he really brought something to the party there as well. He played with those great players, the Brazilians and what have you, Ravinelli, Juninho, those type of players. And he just sparkled, and he makes you feel, you meet Paul now, and I've done, you know, do a couple of things at Sky with him, and you just feel great afterwards that you bumped into him. And even there now, you know, it's bringing back memories. He's different class.
We've had a massive response. I just want to read some of these texts. Gerald, will you ask Niall, does he still have the same donkey jacket and Neil Young embroidered jeans that he wore when he togged out opposite me at a Dublin trial before he went out onto the pitch and made a fool out of me? I'm not giving my name, no way, says that texter.
You know, I had a girlfriend there way back now. We were kids, that's under 14 or something. And Neil Young, Harvest, was a famous album out at the time. And for a birthday present, she asked to borrow my jeans, and she put the album cover, Harvest, Neil Young, on my jeans in embroidery, and I thought it was brilliant. And obviously it got him remembering something about it. But well, that's fantastic.
I was a student in Maynooth in the 1980s. After doing summer exams, we decided to go to the Phoenix Park to the races. It was just before the Irish squad left for Euro 88, and they were all there. We were starstruck, says Marie in Ennis. And I always remember that Niall Quinn was so nice and wished me well in my exams. A true gent.
Wow. Yeah, Jack brought us to the races, and he backed 5 out of 6 winners, and we convinced him to go to the pub afterwards. And that was where this thing, what you might have heard of it, a Jackie, buy us a pint. And that's where it started, coming from the races. We were staying at Finstown House out in Lucan. That was our base. And we were on our way back from the races, and we got to the gates of the hotel, and we're all there, grown men, like well-known people, going, Jackie, buy us a pint. And in the end, he went, driver, find a pub. And we all jumped up and down like school children on the bus. And we pulled into a pub up the road, and everyone had a couple of pints. And it was, yeah. I don't remember who we even played, but they're the bits I do remember.
That's just before the Euros, right? So yeah. that texter, like, that's before football goes crazy in this country. It's before, you know, because like a lot of those, I don't know if every single qualifier was on TV, even certainly that campaign. There's not that much love around. Jack wasn't particularly welcome. He'd won that kind of fluky vote in the end. And
only qualified for that tournament because Scotland went and beat Bulgaria. Gary Mackay got a late last-minute goal. And it wasn't uniformal then, so we weren't playing at the same time. Our games were done by then. And we played a friendly the night before at Dalymount. And I'd stayed around for an extra day to see my family. And I was down in a snooker hall in Rathmines watching the game in between playing snooker. I'd not really been interested in it. And Maurice Setters, Jack's number two, was doing the studio analysis, and he was giving out about the Scots. They're not trying a yard. It's a joke. Don't know why we're even looking at this game. And then all of a sudden he's jumping around like a lunatic, you know, and we're on our way to the Euros. It was pretty incredible. I could talk to you about luck all night.
that whole craziness that happens after the Euros, was there any sense of it before the tournament? Do you remember anything?
No, and I'll go back maybe 12 months earlier. You know, there was, I can remember taxi drivers shouting at us if we were going for a walk down Grafton Street or around that area in our tracksuits or whatever. And you're sort of an embarrassment and all this kind of stuff. And when it all changed, I think it was actually a friendly match that it changed in. We beat Brazil. And it was only a friendly, but it was amazing to think that we'd beaten Brazil, and that it really lifted everything. And everybody started to believe then. There's a very funny story going on. The night before the game, Jack brought us to train on the pitch, and the groundsman was about to cut the grass, and Jack nearly strangled him, you know. There was no way he was allowed to cut the grass. And Liam Brady scored a cracker of a goal. I think it was about 86.
87.
87, so
it's
yeah.
My,
so
my 10th birthday, I got to go to that game.
Oh, wow. Jeepers, good on you. And I felt that was the change, because from then on, people were saying, well done, great result, and the atmosphere was better, and... Then, of course, to go to the Euros itself and then beat England, the whole thing was off and running.
Yeah, well, I think I've said to you as well many times, of course, growing up in England, we wouldn't get any of the games at all. So the only games we would have got around that time, I remember Mark Lawrenson's goal against Scotland,
because
it was shown because it was Scotland, it was on British TV. And then we were getting, of course, the Euro games. And then, particularly after that, then Ireland was becoming a lot more high profile. So Big Jack's Army was getting a lot more playing over in England. But then particularly the England games. It was the England games through the qualifiers that I remember, of course, Niall scored the brilliant goal at Wembley. But the performances on that night as well, how we dominated England. And then going on from that further forward, and Cass scored then the one, Tony Cascarino scored at Lansdowne through that campaign. And that's when I was starting to really... take on board everything, all the players, because I mean, you know the story as well, how it was growing. You were just waiting for Ireland to qualify for a tournament. I supported Northern Ireland in 86 because we'd never qualified for a tournament. So to qualify then for 88, and then you actually got the chance to support Ireland as a kid growing up in England, it was extremely special for me. Yeah,
the TV coverage of those England games is class as well, because it's a bunch of very famous. The grandfathers of English football laughing about how crap Ireland were, and then we go and beat them in Euro 88. It's class to watch that back.
It is. And you know, I was a couple of years ago, I was away and I was watching the friendly against England, and Shane Long scored a goal at Wembley for his country. And even though it was a friendly, it just took me right back, like nothing has taken me back in my career before to that moment, because I suppose, you know, the old enemy, there's great tradition of games over the years, but it is something really special. And we had a better team than them then, there's no doubt about that, you know. And they got ahead of us to the qualifiers for the Euros in 92, but we slipped up in a couple of away games. I think it was probably one of the biggest regrets at that time, that England had managed to get past us for the Euros in 92. But for 94, there was no sign of them out in America for the World Cup. We had got there, and For that period of time, we had a far better team. And okay, people say Jack played long ball, but you know, we had top players.
The one thing I do remember from Niall's goal, or Quinny's goal against England, was it was the finish here was very good, but it was a celebration afterwards. And I remember him like swinging his arm around as he's running off when he scored. The celebration always stuck in my mind as well.
Yeah, I was told. I looked a bit stupid, so I never did it again. But I'd seen Mick Shannon do that as a kid growing up, scoring goals for Southampton and Norwich and what have you. And just, I don't know why I did it really, but great night. And I'd been to Ireland-England matches there. When I'd gone over to Arsenal, there was a friendly and on hands time that I went to. And just the whole, because it was old Wembley, it was nearly 100,000 people, they were crammed in. The atmosphere was great, and we played them off the park and should have won the game.
We were brilliant.
There's a night when Jack and his orders went out the window, really. You know, we decided we were actually better than this lot, and Jack couldn't stop us not playing. And afterwards, we kind of had big regrets. You know, we always say we thrashed them 1-1, you know.
Yeah, Houghton, that's the night Houghton has.
He had a great chance at the end, yeah. Now, I always say I was on the far post. No one remembers. If he had just put it across, I'd have tapped it in. But I suppose he was so close to goal.
Yeah.
He probably had to go for it, and there was one or two other chances as well, and they got a kind of a lucky OG, if I remember.
Because people talk about the Russia game in the Euros and us being brilliant for 50 minutes in that game, but in the England game we were brilliant for the whole game.
Yeah, and that Russia game as well, Tony Galvin got scythed down, hacked down for a penalty, and it wasn't given. That was another big regret. And I actually played a part in that famous Ronnie Whelan goal. I was warming up, the ball went out for a throw, and I threw it to Mick McCarthy. He threw it to the edge of the box, and Ronnie put the volley in. Off his shin, I know. But that was my probably my best involvement for a couple of years around that barren spell in the Irish team.
You're only about 22 in 88. Are you even 22?
Probably 23.
Right, okay. Yeah. So you're just breaking into the team at that stage.
Yeah, I was kind of a late developer because I had the 2 or 3 years you know, standing still at Arsenal. And really, it didn't change for me until the World Cup in 90. You know, I really enjoyed 88. It was fantastic. I got a run against England in that famous game where Ray scored. And I wasn't brought on again after that. And we went so close, as you know, to getting to the semi-final. So that was all great. And the qualifiers for 90, I was still just getting a sub appearance every now and then. And the big break came for me after the Egypt game in the 1990 World Cup. Jack, and you could see him making the decision in the training ground a day or so before the game. You know, Tony was pretty flat. Jack had been quite hard on him in training. And he just changed it around, said, OK, Tony, off you go. It was just a training thing. He went, Niall, you go in there. And of course, I couldn't wait for my chance. And they went with me the next day. And I got in again, scored. Van Breukelen threw one to me. I stayed in the team whenever I was fit for every qualifier from then until we played Holland again and Jason McAteer scored. Mick went without me that day. That was the first time, I think. So it was an amazing goal to get, an amazing time, because it actually gave me 11 years in the team. That's what I got out of that night.
Yeah, and like, but that said, your club career had already taken off, or
I went back after the World Cup to Man City. I'd had a good finish to the season. I joined Man City in March, and we were bottom of the league, and we managed to stay up very comfortably. I scored a few goals, went back, and had a great year at City. I think I got 22 goals that year, and the goal at Wembley. And so you know, things were good, and got a pay rise, sort of earning money where I thought I was God's gift, and life was really good then. Yeah,
and that's the value of international football. We kind of talked about it with Shane Long. Everybody was hoping that goal would kick on his club career, and it just hasn't happened. But you can see why international football means so much to a lot of Irish players.
I think it was always, we was on a bit before though, just to quit now before we got to break. It was you scored 22 goals in the old First Division, so it was just before it went to the Premier League.
Last year.
So we wouldn't have had many. It's only probably Robbie Keane who's been anywhere near that sort of total and maybe got above 20 goals, certainly Premier League goals.
I don't think Robbie Keane scored 20 goals.
Yeah, Robbie scored. I think Robbie has scored 20. I think he has scored, once or twice. Yeah. Well, he's definitely scored 100 Premier League goals. He's got over 100 Premier League. But I mean, we've had very few strikers that have got anywhere near that over the last 20, 25 years.
Thanks, Kev.
Yeah, well, I'm here for you, Niall. You know I'm here for you.
You always were.
Zlatan's missed a chance. Man United had a penalty appeal waved away. So it's 1-1 and it's headed for extra time with 23 minutes left in that game. Loads of text coming through. 53106 is the text number. Niall is staying with us. We'll be right back after these.
News Talks Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
Thanks to Air, with UEFA Champions and Europa Leagues action. Brought to you by Air Sport.
Just to run you through the scores in the Europa League, it's Beşiktaş 2, Lyon 1 on the night. That's 3-3 on aggregate, so they are also headed for extra time. It's Genk 1, Celta Vigo 1. That's a 4-3 lead for Celta Vigo as it stands. It's Man United 1, Anderlecht 1. That's 2-2 on aggregate, headed for extra time as it stands as well. And it is Schalke 2-0 up on the night against Ajax, 2-2 on aggregate, so also headed for extra time. So not much clarity in the picture with about 15 minutes left to go in the game there. A tweet, my granddad Joe Walsh was the bus driver for the Irish team back in 88 to 94. He said, Niall was a gent and Jack owes him a quid for an Irish Indo.
Jeepers, what a great memory. A lovely man, a pure gentleman. I remember Joe well. They were part of the team. You know, everyone, there was a group of lads, you know, and Mick Byrne epitomised it, of course. He was sort of the leader of the staff, and Charlie O'Leary, the crack we used to have. I mean, Kev, they were still there in your time. It was just amazing, wasn't it?
They were incredible people. Charlie, I would have had a couple of campaigns with Charlie just before the World Cup in 02. But when I first came in 97, the two of them, just brilliant characters in the squad. They lifted everybody. You come in, you might have had a bad spell at your club, or you might have been having a bad spell, even a bad game, and you're in a double header. Those two, they just lifted everything around the squad, and they were there for everybody. You know, the amount of times that Mick would have gone round to every individual, because Mick had a great way, Mick Byrne especially, of sensing when someone needed that little bit of time, just 5 minutes with him, 10 minutes, half an hour, whatever it would be, and he was superb.
Charlie was really sharp as well, though. Like, Charlie was in his 80s by the end, but remember this absolutely fabulous looking girl walking by reception, like, you know, and Tony Cascarino looking at Charlie, like, you know, and Tony goes, would you? And I'll never forget Charlie going, like playing snooker with a rope, Tony, like playing snooker with a rope. We all just fell about the place laughing. It's after the watershed, is it?
we're clear now. About the 1988 training camp, Pat Mack wants to know, ask Niall if he remembers the 88 Ireland training at Finstown House. I think you do because you mentioned it.
Yeah, very well.
Most of the team spent today golfing in the Hermitage, except Niall and a few of the lads spent today on the beer playing snooker instead.
Yeah, that's right. We were allowed to play 9 holes and Jack went off fishing or something and few went out golfing and then 3 or 4 went, there's a snooker table in there, we won't have to golf at all and we can have a few pints and it was good. But it was kind of, I know you could, see, you could do it then and there was no pressure on and there was no visibility, people couldn't see, you know, and it was lovely because built up a great fun and you wouldn't get drunk, you'd have a few pints, you'd just be giddy and you'd get back on the bus and, you know, Jack would ask how you played and all the lads would be laughing and go, oh, I did all right, Jack, you know, and, you know, I put one in the bunker on the 7th, like, you know, and you're kind of slurring your words and stuff, like, you know, but it was a great memory, that Finstown House trip. That was the start of it, really. You know, we kind of kicked on and beat England a few weeks later, so, or a couple of, well, days later almost. And I was actually in it recently during the week. I was at a meeting there in Finstown House. Now, it's all different now. The golf course is gone. There was 9 holes beside it, but now it's all kind of houses and offices and that. But the memories came flooding back all right.
You were obviously on tour with these guys and had some good times.
I got the back end. I got the right at the
Central
end.
Central America a couple of times?
Yeah, I did. And we had
Mark Kennedy?
We had America in 2000. And I think that was probably, Niall was obviously the father figure of our squad at
was
that time.
Did you get sent off on that tour? Or was that
without playing, yeah, I got sent off from the bench against Mexico. Yeah.
Did you? Yeah. We'd arrived, we had 3 games. So we flew to Chicago first and we flew into Boston. The game was abandoned in Boston for about 15, 20 minutes because the wind and rain came down. And we went back out and played the last 15, 20 minutes in that game. But Mick wouldn't let us out. So we got to Chicago. Mick wouldn't let us out. Lads wanted a few pints after we played Mexico in Chicago, wasn't it? I think it was. Then we flew to Boston to play America. And Mick wouldn't let us out after either of those games. And we had a really good night out lined up in Boston. Still no night out. So the following day we get on the bus then when we drove from Boston down to New York. So we get down to New York. But Mick actually let us have a few beers on the bus on the way down. So we then arrived down into New York, and probably maybe said this one before. We arrived back into New York. It's about 2 o'clock, 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever it was. And Mick said, right, I want everybody at dinner for 5 o'clock tomorrow evening. So we had 24, 30 hours, whatever it would be. Probably would have been, probably about 20, 28 hours it would be. And the lads, you imagine what the lads did. The lads went, we didn't go down shopping. We're on just off Fifth Avenue. We're in the middle of New York, Manhattan. I've never been to New York in my life. Let's just go and find the nearest Irish pub. So we were 2 blocks down the road and we just stayed in this pub till whatever o'clock it was originally. So we first get into the pub and the lads were doing whatever. So there was Shay giving myself, Niall obviously, I don't know if Stan was there actually, but Robbie Keane was on that trip, Richard Dunn. They were too young to drink, so we had to go. We went to a pub where we could actually manufacture a drink illegally for some of the younger boys, didn't we?
Didn't you?
Yeah. and it was great, but on this one particular session that we were there, we're having night out. Quinny was worse for wear. Quinny rarely ever gets worse for wear. But Gary Quinny had these cowboy boots. Quinny used to have these knee high cowboy boots. So the lads were slaughtering Quinny like snakeskin cowboy boots. Not Neil Young than anything else. Spoke about Neil Young before. Well. And Gary Kelly managed to take Quinny's boot off him. I don't know how he got it off you, in fairness. He's gone out into the street and he's threw it into the road. Now, we're talking, we were probably 6th Avenue. We're 2 or 3 down. It was chock-a-block the whole day. Thousands and thousands of cars going up this road. This was 3, 4 in the afternoon, wherever it was. Anyway, we were worse for wear. Quinny's walked around the whole day with one boot on, one boot off in this pub in the middle of Manhattan. And then we get out of the pub. Anyway, I think we get thrown out of the pub at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock that night. And Quinny's boot is still in the middle of the road.
I remember.
Quinny walks out into the middle of the road and just picks up this boot, puts the boot on casually, and just walks on to the next pub wherever we're going to that night as if nothing had happened.
You know, you're so right. I remember that. Because you know what happened? When we went into the pub first, right, I went, better get the lads a bit of grub. And I went up and there was a kind of a food bit on the side and there was, like, you know, the bar bit. And it was quite a big place. And the girl said, what's your name? I'll call you when you're ready, right? So I gave her my name and we all sat down, told her to get sandwiches and all the rest of it for the lads. And we were all sat in the corner, over in the far corner, and I was sitting beside Gary Doherty, right, who was on the trip. And all of a sudden the thing comes over, Niall Quinn, make himself known to Barca. He's going, oh, you're a legend. You're a legend. And I was going, what? He went, they even know you in this pub, mate. You know? What's going on? I've ordered the sandwiches. He went, oh, right.
Do you remember outside the pub as well, there was a little, there was a sign for the pub outside as well.
It looked like
Gary Carter, the big notes from Gary, big ginger hair on him as well, the sign for the Irish pub outside. Oh, so the lads were bringing it inside and putting it next to Gary Dock in the pub.
Oh, man.
Oh, dear.
It is a pity in some way that there's no social media, because at least we'd have a record of it.
Oh, God, we would have been in trouble. We would have been in trouble at that time, yeah. Certainly would have been. But it was great to have. Then, you know what, on that trip as well, we drew with America, drew with Mexico, and then we beat South Africa. And I remember Mark Kennedy and me in the third game, we were sub, and I mean, it was about 100 degrees in New York. We're playing in Giant Stadium. So we're playing, and 20 minutes into the game, the lads are dead on the feet. So Mick turns to Sparky and me, lads, you're going on. And me and him looking at each other, we were warming up for 5 minutes and we were dead. Anyway, went on and we ended up beating, I think we played South Africa, we beat South Africa, but it was a great trip. Great trip in all in the end, yeah.
So you got a draw. I think, was South Africa.
No, I think we beat them.
Did we?
I think we did. We were 1-0 down. I think we ended up winning.
How did you get sent off on the bench?
Well, it was, I can't quite remember. I think I was having a go at the linesman or something. Liam Daish had just got sent off.
There was like three players sent off.
Yeah, well, Liam and I were sent
off.
That was the one before.
That was 96.
That was 96. And we both got sent off. And it was a real long walk to where you go to, because they wouldn't let us even go up into the stands. So we had to make this big, long walk around the back of the goal before the game restarted. It was really embarrassing and everybody was booing. I was sent off as Liam was sent off. And I can remember being in the tunnel, like, you're going, and Liam looking at each other, and we kind of almost laughing, like, you know, this is mad, isn't it? And with that, Mick McCarthy walked around the corner. And our first thought was, oh my God, he's walked all this way to have a go at us. And he looked at us with this big, rough face and went, I've just got sent off as well. And we all had a laugh. Oh, it was a mad moment.
Loads of still texts coming in. Paul from Meath says, I met Niall when I won a weekend in Oysterhaven in Cork, courtesy of Mars. He was our celebrity team captain, although in brackets, I was hoping for Olivia Tracy. I played a couple of sets of tennis against him and he beat me well. Is there any sport this man can play? You did win the genetic lottery when it comes to sports.
Well, no, I had a go at everything. But I remember that trip, actually. And Tony Ward, what I was remember, Tony Ward, the famous rugby man, he was in charge of a team. Now, when you think about it, this was an adventure weekend and there was teams. Olivia Tracy, a most gorgeous, lovely lady, and she had her team. And there was a rally driver, Austin McHale, I think, was another one. And so my memory from that trip, Tony Ward was perfectly tanned in a white tracksuit. Now, this was, you know, not sharp, from bog snorkeling to boating to getting things up the mountain, down the mountain. And every day at the end of the day, his white tracksuit stayed perfectly white. And God, he didn't even know who I was. He'd probably never even met me. He knew probably that I played football. And I just had enough one time. And myself and a couple of our team just went, we've had enough of him. And we just threw him into this big mud thing. You know? And he was devastated. He took it really badly. So if you're listening, Tony, I'm really sorry.
5-3-1-0-6 our text number. We're going to take one last break for you. It's 1-1 between Man United and Anderlecht. It is still Genk 1, Celta Vigo 1. And so it's as you were in the other two games as well. Man United need a goal in the next 5 minutes. Otherwise, we're headed for extra time.
Off the ball. Thanks to Air. Munster have made it to the semi-final of the European Rugby Champions Cup. Available to watch live exclusively on the Air Sport Pack.
Damo has been in touch by text to say, Charlie O'Leary, a lovely man until you got sent off in the Leinster Junior League and you had to go before him chairing the disciplinary committee in Parnell Square on a Thursday night. He dished out the suspensions like snuff at a wake.
Charlie wasn't like that.
The news from the Dublin Championship is that the 2016 All-Ireland Club Football Champions are out. Ballyboden St. Enda's 13 points, St. Plunkett's 2 goals and 10, a 3-point win for a star-laden St. Plunkett's team tonight in the Dublin Football Championship. We're very lucky to get you tonight because this is normally a night where you're training the football team.
Oh yeah, cheapers. You're bringing that up, are you? Ah yeah, no, I train my daughter's ladies team up in Eadstown, so everything was going great. We were flying there, Ger. I was telling everybody how well we're doing, but Comfy gave us an absolute thrashing there on Tuesday night, so I'm trying to pick up bruised egos at the moment.
What's the thrashing, Quinny?
A fair hiding in this neck of the woods, Kev. 7-16-1-7. Not Ooh. Quite as bad as Erin's Isle against Crokes earlier on tonight, but enough anyway for our girls to get a reality check. We'd won a few games and I suppose we might have been getting a bit carried away, but it's great fun. I really love it. And you know, I don't know any GAA training really. I'm kind of doing soccer drills with handball allowed, you know, and they're buying into it. They're a great bunch. They're so good. and I'm getting my shorts on and running around again for the first time in years, embarrassing the life out of my daughter, but also spending quality time with her, which I haven't done for years. So it's really good, and they're putting up with me and they're listening and sort of trying to implement what I'm saying. It's a great bit of crack.
You're pulling that Roy Keane trick of not appearing after a defeat just to make them bruise.
Yeah, they're meant to be training tonight, and I made the mistake actually on the WhatsApp group of saying I won't be there, and then loads of girls went, oh, actually I've got babysitting, and actually I've got different things going on. So the poor fella Jer Cavan, who helps me out there, and Colin Dempsey, the two of them, I think they've probably got a handful of people up there tonight.
I did want to ask you a little bit about Sunderland. We were chatting earlier on about Jesse Lingard and I was making the point that there's a tax at Manchester United if you come through and you make the first team squad, where you can't be earning 100 grand a week less than everybody else. Like, even if you're not good enough to be earning 80-100 grand, they just have to pay that money, because otherwise you're going to be sitting there with a face on you, and you're a squad member, and the rules of engagement at Man United are just a little bit different.
Yeah, well, I suppose I can only speak from my own experience, and you're trying to break through back in the day as a player. It was pretty Victorian really then, in terms of trying to get some sort of deal for yourself. You're just looking to get a contract. But the way it's gone, you know, the Bosman ruling, actually, I was actually out in Luxembourg. I was invited, the Irish Chamber of Commerce invited me out there, and they brought me to the court where Bosman won his ruling and changed football and changed the soccer world forever. Poor man ended up destitute afterwards for his troubles. But what Bosman did really has just been incredible for the player. And the player and the agents in this world have kicked it on. So much so now that if you are going into that position where you make a breakthrough in a club, I know they have this rule, you know, you're 21, there will always be a type of fee involved if the player is moving on. But you have so much power before you've actually done anything. Mm. It's quite incredible. And I found it hard to see the motivation in young players, that desperation to get in the team. It's taken from them by giving them salaries that directors living in huge houses in the poshest part of town aren't getting. And you have that before you've even learned to be a footballer. You have it, you know, too easy, and it's a danger, you know. And suddenly, you know, you're buying brand new, I suppose, Jaguar cars, and you know, all these people turn up in your life selling you cars, selling you watches, selling you things, and you end up in a false bubble, Jer. And I've seen it now. Reason I'm talking is I've seen it now at Sunderland with young players, and trying very hard to get them to put it away if you have to pay them money, mm-hmm. and try and get them to sort out, but they're creatures of habit. And if there was anything I could change back in my time, it would be where you gave players 2 or 3 years of a contract, that you actually pay them over 10 or 15, you know, the same amounts. If there was some way that football could elongate the amount of money that comes their way over a longer period of time, even though you might just have 3 year contracts.
Did you feel as though that you were restricted? Did you feel as though that you had blocks put in front of you when you were probably paying players contract or paying players wages that you didn't necessarily think they were good enough to actually get?
I knew they weren't going to make it, but at the same time, if they did okay for us, we'd get a fee for them somewhere if we had them under contract. Therefore, we had to contract them, and that's the place you go as a footballer. If you're not that good, you're earning a load of money, and then when your contract ends, or if you go somewhere else and it doesn't work out for you, you're not really able to have that kind of dream and that life again, and people get very bitter and they fade away. There's a whole debate there around, you know, I suppose how footballers deal with the sort of coming out of the mad world into the real world. The whole transition is another debate. But at that particular point where kids are, and having been told they're the best in the country when they're 14, 15, 16, haven't had that all through them, you know, 18, 19, 20, and haven't had big contact, even, you know, players who haven't got near the first team, who are earning sort of, you know, a few thousand a week, when you think about it, having done absolutely nothing in the game. And if it doesn't work out from a year or two later, it's very hard for them to ever reach those kind of salaries again in their lives. They've really got to switch off and find. I think it's a problem in certain respects. But that said, you know, you have to play the game as a football club, and you have to get involved in that whole lottery.
I mean, I work, Lee Carsley's under 18 coach at City, and you know the wages that they're paying at Man City now. Man City, lowest paid player at the club's on 200 grand a year, whatever it would be. That's the lowest paid player at 17, as soon as he turns 17, which it shows how far it's come, the game, in a relative short space of time, and shows where the game is actually going to. So you're talking, that's the minimum wage, or so you're going up to 17, 18 year old boys that are never probably likely to kick a ball in the first team, and they'll be on in excess of $1 million a year.
It's quite incredible. And what you look for, and what I looked for, the odd time I'd sort of go down close up front, if you like, with them, and personal with the youth teams and those who were coming through and those who were given contracts to. I'd go to the games on a Saturday morning as chairman, and I would talk a lot to Jed McNamee, who's the coach. We wanted the ones who, it didn't matter what you gave them, that they had a desire to go through with it and that they'd work hard. And I suppose the successes that we had there, I mean, Jordan Henderson probably being the one, you could give Jordan any amount of money, it meant nothing, you know. And that's the type of frame of mind you need as a young footballer going through. Let that just pile up somewhere. Don't get caught up in it. Don't buy fancy cars. Don't go off blowing it as you get it. Don't think it's that important. Just get it out of your life and have that sort of driven desire in yourself that no matter what the money is, I'm going to the top. And that's what Jordan Henderson had. He's the best example of all the young people around that I saw coming through. He was a little 14, 15 year old. I have a picture of him when I was finishing my career at Sunderland. I came back as chairman and he was there edging to try and get into the first team squad, and we sent him out on loan to Coventry. And Ray Ranson was the Coventry CEO at the time, and Ray rang me and went, how much do you want for Henderson? And to be quite honest with you, that was the point when I knew he's actually doing it there as well, what he's doing with us. He's going to be a footballer. And I went, Ray, you're not going to be able to buy him.
That was prescient. And amongst many of the million of brilliant decisions you made, we've had a massive response by text. To distill them all down into one, it's Niall Quinn's a top bloke.
I doubt it, if only they knew me. No.
Zlatan's been injured at the end of that game. It's finished 1-1. Looks like he hyperextended.
Well, it's not a challenge actually, he's just fell awkwardly on his knee, so that looks a bad one for Ibrahimovic and United.
No, we really enjoyed this. It was brilliant. Thanks a million for coming in.
Thanks very much, guys. A pleasure.
Tom Dunn is up next. That's our lot tonight. Brian O'Driscoll in studio tomorrow night, previewing the weekend's rugby. We'll see you then. Good night.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.